Acts 19, beginning at verse 21, as we're going to look at the invocation of a God that was a very powerful God in her culture, one that had existed for over a millennia in Ephesus, the goddess Artemis, or the goddess Diana, as the Romans would call her. Invoking Artemis is our title, and this invocation of Artemis comes in the midst of a great, great riot that is caused not by Paul and the missionaries, they're just the catalyst to it. It's caused by an idol maker named Demetrius, who is very frustrated that his profits are going down because Paul is being so successful in his mission. And you're guaranteed when the gospel begins to touch areas of life like the bottom line, the profit margin, that trouble's brewing ahead for the people of God. And that's what's going to occur in our story. Just to give you a background, last week we looked at the seven sons of Sceva. You may remember them. They were the prophets who claimed to be experts in exorcism. They're the ones that got beat up by the one demon-possessed man. They wanted to bring him out, the demon out, through the name of Jesus, whom Paul preaches. So they thought that Jesus' name was a ritualistic word that they could use to try to get at the demons, but instead this plot backfired on them completely, and it was because of the humiliation they experienced and this complete failure that the Christians actually began to see the vanity of their own interest in the arcane arts in Ephesus. And they began to throw away their paraphernalia and the money that was thrown away, the estimated amount of the books and the scrolls and all the paraphernalia that was destroyed was 50,000 drachmas, which is just unbelievable. We're talking millions and millions of dollars. It was all thrown away because they were repenting. They had seen that these arcane arts were not for them. This is something they needed to take care of. So we're seeing even more that the bottom line, the profit margin for all those who deal with this kind of stuff is getting lower and lower, as well as those who create idols and those who make shrines. They're also losing profits. And that's what's going to lead to our big conflict today. But before we get to that story, you'll see it in verse 23. It's the riot in Ephesus. There's a small little transitional paragraph we didn't cover last week. We ended at verse 20. So after all this had happened, the burning of the scrolls and all of that, are you all with me? 21, thank you. Paul decided to go to Jerusalem, passing through Macedonia and Achaia. After I have been there, he said, I must visit Rome also. And it's important that we deal with that transitional text because in that little phrase, Luke has outlined the remainder of the book. This is Paul's plan, and he's actually going to achieve this plan because of the success in Ephesus. He has set his sights high. He's going to go to Rome. It's as if he's moving from Milwaukee to Chicago and realizing, you know, if I'm going to really reach the world with the gospel, I need to go to D.C. I need to go to Washington. And so he wants to go to the center of the empire's power, into the heart of the beast itself, and proclaim the gospel there. And so he, in Ephesus, which is right here, decides that he's going to, on this third missionary journey, visit all the churches in Macedonia and Achaia that he has formerly planted. And then he's going to make his way back to Jerusalem. And then from there, he hopes to get to Rome, which is exactly what's going to happen as this book plays out. Just to give an idea of where Rome is at, here's Ephesus again, right here. Here's where he goes back to all the churches he's visited. He goes back to Jerusalem, and then Rome is all the way out here. He's going to go there as a prisoner, and we'll see how that takes place once we get him to Jerusalem. But that transition's important. That's the remainder of the book. Acts has always been about getting the gospel from Jerusalem to Judea to Samaria to the uttermost parts of the earth so that all the world may hear the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. Paul has his sights set on Rome because if he gets there, then he's got to the center. And so that's his goal. It's going to come true. And so in verse 22, he sent two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, to Macedonia while he stayed in the province of Asia a little longer. And it's while he's staying in this province a little longer that this riot occurs. And so now we're still in Ephesus. The plans haven't come true yet. They're just plans at this point. But this is when trouble brews. The $50,000 worth of paraphernalia has been destroyed, but there's also a big cut in the idol business. And Demetrius, who we're going to be introduced here to in verse 23, is not happy about that. Verse 23, about that time, there arose a great disturbance about the way of Jesus. A silversmith named Demetrius, who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought in no little business for the craftsmen. He called them all together, the craftsmen in his guild, we suppose, along with the workmen in related trades, and said, "Men, you know we receive a good income from this business. And you see and hear how this fellow Paul has convinced and led astray large numbers of people here in Ephesus and in practically the whole province of Asia. He says that man-made gods are no gods at all. There is danger not only that our trade will lose its good name, but that the temple of the great goddess Artemis will be discredited, and the goddess herself, who is worshipped throughout the province of Asia and the world, will be robbed of her divine majesty." Now, I hope you heard in his speech to the guildsmen that he's claiming that he's concerned about Artemis's honor. But he really, if you read it carefully, we make no little income in this. You do realize this trade is going to be dishonored. So he's using religious language, but behind that is a deeper sense that we're losing money here. And if Paul continues to be successful, we are going to take a big dive in profits. We, in fact, might be in a place where we're not making any money at all. And now that that profit line has been touched, you're going to see that a riot is going to occur in verse 28. But there's an important thing to talk about as far as Artemis. Anyone familiar with Artemis?
Goddess of the hunt.
What's that?
Goddess of the hunt.
Goddess of the hunt. That's right. Goddess of the hunt. She actually is an amelioration of a lot of different things, because since 11th BC, before Christ, 11th century, she had been the chief deity in Ephesus. So she's had a long reign, and she'll continue to be the chief deity until the 3rd century AD. So that this isn't going to undo Artemis, but in her long period of being the goddess of Ephesus, she took on every different kind of connotation you can imagine. Goddess of the hunt, she was the protector of the weak for a while. She was also the goddess of fertility. She was also the goddess of provision. She was also the goddess of debts, a protector of debts. So that the temple was not just a place of worship, but it was also the chief banking institution for Ephesus. So religion and economy are deeply intertwined. Her visage is weird. If you've ever seen Artemis, Artemis looks like that. We have plenty of archaeological things that relate to Artemis. To get up closer, those are breasts. She's a many-breasted god. She's the goddess of fertility and also the goddess of banking. How convenient. And being the goddess of fertility and of banking, worship for her became this unique amalgamation of devotion to Artemis, seeking her for fertility, seeking her for other aspects, but also of protecting one's indebtedness, of making sure that your economy stays strong. And so Paul has had a detrimental impact on the worship of Artemis. He's turned people away from the traditional religion of Ephesus. He's just bad for business. And because he's bad for business, these guildsmen are very, very concerned. I would actually argue Demetrius sees clearly. Everything Demetrius said is true. He sees that if things continue as they are, that Artemis is going to go down in popularity, their business is going to go down, and that they need to do something. He actually sees a head-on clash between Artemis and between whatever deity Paul seems to be proclaiming, which obviously Demetrius has no interest in knowing. He's far more concerned about the prophet rather than to hear truth or the word of the prophet. And so if you look carefully at our text again, If you look at verse 26, you see how this fellow Paul is convinced and led astray large numbers of people here in Ephesus and in practically the whole province of Asia. Remember, he spent 2 years in the lecture hall of Tyrannus. People were coming from all over. We read in verse 10, all people in Asia had heard. So Demetrius understands that all the people, the whole world seems to have heard this. But then he wants to say about Artemis in the last lines of that paragraph, Artemis will be discredited, the goddess herself who is worshipped throughout the province of Asia and the world. So it's Artemis, who's the goddess of Asia and the world, against Paul, who's being heard by all of Asia and the world. And Demetrius is very concerned that Paul's argument is going to eclipse Artemis's honor and in doing that reduce their profits. So he says that to the guildsmen, and here's how the guildsmen respond. His words strike a chord. Verse 28, when they heard this, they were furious and began shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians," which most likely was a hymn. It was a hymn of invoking Artemis. It was also patriotic. It's their song for this region. It's their God. It's Ephesus' God. So it's not only this patriotic song, it is this religious song. And then, strangely enough, it's also an economic song, because Artemis is really caught up in their own welfare economically. So they're shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians! Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" And as they're doing that, the riot spreads out into the streets. Verse 29, soon the whole city was in an uproar. The people seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia, and rushed as one man into the theater. And this had to be terrifying. We assume that this is becoming a violent and out of control riot, with all the fury and fire of the hymn provoking even more strong sense of this is our duty, this is what we've got to stand for Ephesus and all that we believe in and all that is our welfare. This is the theater that they go to. It's a theater that can seat 24,000 people. This is one angle of it. You can kind of see the steps here on the side and how it even went up higher and people could gather not just on the seats but all around. So it's estimated that about 24,000 people in its prime could gather together. And what you need to do to get into this story is imagine that Paul's companions, who've been faithful to him in proclaiming the gospel, are caught up in the rush of the crowd, Aristarchus and Gaius, and they are brought into the theater as thousands of people are shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" It looks like everything could go bad. I mean, it's a lynching mob. It looks like blood could spill very, very soon, because you got a crowd that's just on the verge of being out of control. So here's what Paul wants to do. Talk about boldness. And perhaps stupidity. Verse 30. Paul wanted to appear before the crowd, but the disciples would not let him. So Paul's thinking, and who knows why he's thinking this. You would think he'd know better. You can't reason with the unreasonable. There's no way to win. Does he really think he's going to go into the midst and calm everyone down, the very person that this debate and controversy is about? But he wants to go, but thankfully the disciples have cooler heads. And they said, "Paul, this isn't a fight you can win. You can't go in there." Verse 31, even some of the officials of the province, the Asiarchs, these are high officials in Ephesus government, friends of Paul, sent him a message begging him not to venture into the theater. That's important, because all of a sudden we realize how great an influence Paul has had in Ephesus. He's got friends in high places. He's got elite people in aristocracy that have accepted the message of Christ, and they're saying, "Paul, you're a friend. You can't go in there. They'll kill you. Our people will kill you." And so you begin to see how much the message of the gospel's infiltrated Ephesus, and that's the reason for this riot. So thank God, cooler heads prevail. Paul doesn't go and get dismembered or beaten or stoned again. Instead, he's watching on the sidelines. Now here's how crazy the mob was. And boy, you know, when the mob rules, there are no rules. Verse 32, the assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. Most of the people did not even know why they were there. That's confusion. They can't keep the message straight. Many of them don't even know what the message is. It's just this wonderful, patriotic, enthusiastic, something's wrong and we got to find a scapegoat to take our rage out upon. Who is it? We don't know, but heck, let's just go with the mob. So some can't even say what it's about. They can't keep their message straight. They're just swept along in the passion of the moment. And that passion becomes so heated that we're going to see by the end of this paragraph, for 2 hours they're going to chant, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." Look at verse 33. The Jews pushed Alexander to the front. We don't know who Alexander is. This is the only time he's mentioned. No idea. He could be a fellow Jew. He could be a Christian. He could be, as in many mobs, just someone who happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, who becomes the scapegoat. Because when you riot and you're angry, you have to blame it on another. You have to find a scapegoat. The problem is them. Well, who's the them? Well, whoever the scapegoat is. And at this point, poor Alexander, who we know nothing of, gets tossed up front. So he's right there up front. And some of the crowd shouted instructions to him. He motioned for silence in order to make a defense before the people. But when they realized he was a Jew, they all shouted in unison for about 2 hours, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." So all of a sudden you realize there's a deep anti-Semitism here along with the opposition to Paul and his message, which is understandable. Both Jews and Christians have a very poor view of idolatry. They do not tolerate it. If you remember when Paul and the church brought in the Gentiles, they said, "We believe you can come in by faith in Jesus alone. Just do these four things." And they all revolved around, "Don't be idolatrous. We can't tolerate idolatry. So for the sake of the Jews in the church, you Gentiles, please restrain from bloodshed and things polluted by idols and other such things." So both Jews and Christians were known for having a very, very poor view, a very negative view of idolatry. And so as soon as they hear that Alexander is a Jew, the anti-Semitism comes out strong and they just say, "We're not going to hear from a Jew. You know, you're not the one that's going to tell us what to do. So, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. Great is Artemis." You could throw in a lot of slogans there if you get creative, where the mob gets crazy and they just simply are chanting whatever is the slogan that basically is saying, "We're number one, we're the best, all the rest of you are trash." Because that's what's going on here. We are it. Our God is it. And they will not tolerate any dissenters. And they particularly are not happy with the Jews at this point, even though it's the Christians that actually instigated this, or at least were the catalyst for this problem. Well, here's what happens in our story. The situation is so dire, thousands screaming out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." And one of the tragedies of this story is a bureaucrat saves the day. But that's what happens. Although, let's hear it for the city clerks. Verse 35, the city clerk. So, is Cindy a city clerk? Cindy Comro?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is Cindy Comro saves the day. You know, everyone's got to have their moment where they're shining. And this city clerk is the one that resolves this problem. The city clerk quieted the crowd and said, "Men of Ephesus, doesn't all the world know that the city of Ephesus is the guardian of the temple of the great Artemis and of her image which fell from heaven? Since these facts are undeniable, you ought to be quiet and not do anything rash." Which you could paraphrase. He says, you all know we're number one, and our goddess chose Ephesus to be the place where her image landed. That's undeniable. I mean, it's just undeniable that we are the place where the goddess chose to land. We're the best. So that's just the truth, guys. So cool down. I'm with you on that. But he gives three reasons why they need to dismiss this unlawful assembly. Three reasons in three verses. Verse 37. You have brought these men here, though they have neither robbed temples nor blasphemed our goddess. Which is true. Paul and the Christians aren't temple robbers. They haven't blasphemed the goddess. They might deny her or want nothing to do with her, but they haven't necessarily blasphemed her because they haven't in any way tried to worship her. So the city clerk says, there's no legal evidence here. There's no basis for a charge. This is an unlawful assembly. And then he moves on in 38 and says, if then Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a grievance against anybody, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. They can press charges. If there's anything further you want to bring up, it must be settled in legal assembly, which is good bureaucracy speak, for there are proper channels for this. There are lawful means to deal with a complaint. And if you really have a complaint, Demetrius, in your guild, the courts are open. You can press charges. You can bring up your complaints in a court of law. We have those avenues open, not this unlawful assembly. And then the third reason, which is the reason that stills them all. As it is, verse 40, we are in danger of being charged with rioting because of today's events. In that case, we would not be able to account for this commotion since there is no reason for it. And you may not hear it, but what he's saying is we're in danger of offending Rome. And Rome does not take lightly to riots for no reason. We will have to deal with Roman response, and it won't be good. And so since we're under the eagle eye of Roman officials, being a region of the Roman Empire, this disturbance of the public order is something they will take note of and we will pay dearly for. So there's lawful ways to come at this. They haven't really broken any laws, and we don't want Rome to hear about this. So we need to dismiss. And of course, that's what happens. The city clerk keeps the peace. Verse 41, after he said this, he dismissed the assembly. Now, dismissed doesn't give you any sense that anyone feels good about the outcome. I guarantee Demetrius and the guildsmen are angry with this outcome. They see legitimate reasons for their complaint. They're the ones behind this protest. I don't think that necessarily any Jew listening or any Christian would necessarily see this as anything other than, at least we have peace. So that nothing really has happened legally as much as there's been a brilliant move on the part of the city clerk to say, you know what? Bureaucratically, we have no ground to stand on, so let's just dismiss. Now, before you get too inebriated with this clerk's response, thinking, wow, maybe the city clerk has some sympathies for the Jews or the Christians. Remember what the clerk said at the beginning. Verse 35, men of Ephesus, doesn't all the world know that the city of Ephesus is guarding of the temple of the great Artemis and her image, which fell from heaven? These facts are undeniable. In other words, what the clerk is saying is, you know, the Christians might accuse us of idolatry, but it's not idolatry. The image came to us. It's not something made with human hands. The image just fell from the heavens. And that was the legend with Artemis, and we assume as moderns that a meteor must have fell, that must have looked strangely like the many-breasted Artemis figure that we have, and that the people, not knowing about meteors, somehow assumed, well, the gods have just tossed this on our plate, and so that they then begin to make replicas of it. The town clerk is now saying, you know, we really aren't idolaters here because nobody made this image. It was given to us. It came down from heaven. So when we make replicas of it, you know, it's not idolatry because the original is something not made by human hands. And after all, we are the greatest. You know, we got our act together. It's undeniable, guys. And the town clerk is a bit right because the worship of Artemis will go to the 3rd century BC. It'll carry on. It doesn't lose ground. Christianity doesn't by any means stop it. It carries on, continues, even though there's this significant riot. So that's our story. Let me make two reflections, maybe two and a half, because I don't think the third one's that great. So we'll call it a half. But the first one is this. One of the things you clearly see in this story is that there is no compromise with idolatry. There is a sense in which Demetrius, the silversmith, tells more truth than the city clerk. Because Demetrius at least recognizes if the Christians have their way, we're going to lose profits. Because Paul clearly does not see the shrines to Artemis as anything of value. In fact, he was behind the burning of all the arcane scrolls. He's just not a fan. So Demetrius really sees this is a threat to his industry and to Ephesus because it's a threat to the economy of Ephesus. The town clerk doesn't see that. He sees this as just a religious squabble with some men who actually haven't done anything really wrong. He just doesn't see the full depths and dimensions and the economic challenges of what Christianity brings here. And the reason why there are challenges is Christianity, just like Judaism, has no common ground with idolatry. It has common ground with other things. There are plenty of things that Christianity can overlap with other faiths about, but it has no accommodation for idolatry. You might remember a few weeks back when Paul was in Athens. Do you remember that? Paul in Athens giving his lecture and quoting all of their philosophers approvingly. In him we live, move, and have our being, and we are called God's sons. And Paul seems to accommodate the Christian message to be able to bring in insights from philosophy. Paul's able to do that. He can accommodate and adjust his message so he's able to find a point of common ground and then speak the gospel. But it seems like Paul has no place to find common ground around an idol. Now, you might think, well, that's no big deal. We don't have idols. Colossians 3 says greed is an idol. idolatry is more than just bowing before an image. It is finding ultimate value in something or someone so that almost anything can become an idol. And so it's interesting to me that Christianity always tends to turn the tables on its culture because let's all face it, as Calvin said, we have an idol factory in our heart. We just, pump out the idols. We tend to do that. And anytime Christianity gets a real strong hold in a community's life or a person's life, it's going to be at the very least challenging the idols that others hold in such high esteem and in great honor. And in doing that, it's going to be a countercultural force and a misunderstood force because it is challenging those idols. It just has no place to accommodate them. There's no overlap there. So that's kind of what's going on in our story. There's no common ground in Ephesus so that Paul can't find a place to weave in this other than saying this is no good. Get rid of these arcane books and, Artemis is not God. Jesus is Lord. So there is that going on with their no compromise. But that's not unique to Christianity. That actually finds its source in Judaism. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thyself a graven image. Thou shalt not bow down before them. You have one God. I am your God. So that has been there from the beginning of our sacred tradition all the way down to the deep roots of the Jewish religion. Beverly Gaventa says this about how I was talking about the Athens things. Translation of the gospel into philosophical terms is one thing, like Paul did in Athens. Translation into the language of Artemis's cult of idolatry and the shrines to the idol is quite another, since there could be no accommodation for another deity. No speech of Paul's can ameliorate the conflict Demetrius rightly perceives. And that's where you have to give kudos to Demetrius. He sees. He understands. He sees not because he's concerned about the honor of Artemis as much as he's concerned about the padding in his wallet, but he does see. He understands that this could really change things if this religion is to have its way. The second thing is this isn't about religion at all, at least to Demetrius. One of the things we're doing with our kids recently, my boys are so impressive to me because they are such thinkers. They love to think. almost maddeningly so. We talk endless hours about gun control and free will and gender, and I can't tell you all the things that were. Mom and I, Elizabeth and I, just have to say we're done. We want to watch The Voice or something, because I got to turn off my mind. I can't keep going down this route with you. I'm a tired old man. And then they think they've beat me, and I say, you'll never beat me. I will always out-debate you. That's not going to happen. But I'm just tired. I worked all day. They love to think, and I love that about them. They're very, very critical in their thinking. And one of the things that's almost become a running mantra in my house whenever we're looking at any news story is follow the money. Adam Owen, you want to know what this is really about? Follow the money trail. That's really what this is about. It could be any issue. Could be about anything. It's just, you know, follow the money. And we do that a lot. And in this particular story, follow the money. This isn't really about deep devotion to Artemis. I don't doubt that there were people in Ephesus that had a deep devotion to Artemis. I don't doubt that. But I don't think Demetrius has a deep devotion. Demetrius just has a stake in Artemis's continued worship, because he's going to continue to make bucks off of it. He simply just doesn't come across with the language he uses as someone who's really concerned about the honor of a deity. I'd actually sympathize with his true words more if he did, because I can understand seeking the honor of your deity and wanting that to not be diminished. But for him, this is far more about trade rather than temple. And that's why last quote I'll offer you, William Jennings says, Demetrius has evoked a powerful mix and a winning strategy for fostering hatred and mindless violence. If you want people to hate deeply, hate down to the bone, then suggest that someone or something threatens their financial stability and their theological beliefs. You could probably erase that theological beliefs. Just say it threatens their financial stability, and all of a sudden you will create mindless hate and violence. Because when you scratch deeply enough, it really is all about the money far too often, and Demetrius knows that. He is far more interested in prophets than hearing from the prophet. And I guess the challenge for us is to always be willing to hear the prophet, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, before we think about the prophet, P-R-O-F-I-T. That our God cannot be the greenback. Our God must be the God of love and life and truth and beauty revealed in Christ. And that's where our ultimate allegiance lies, no matter what. So the same holds true today. We must always be careful. There can be no compromise with idolatry. We need to be careful that it's just not all about the money. And then good citizens. This, to me, is just important because sometimes in my rants against the different cultures of the day and against our own, you might think that the advocacy is for being a bad citizen. Never. Because the Christians in our story are being good citizens. The irony is, they're the good ones. Demetrius is the one that's created the riot. And we've seen that again and again, where the opposers to Christianity have, for bad reasons, created an environment that's violent and hateful, and they've done it against the Christians. And all the Christians are doing is living their countercultural lifestyle, which unfortunately is perceived to be very aggressive, when really it's just a different way to live. And so, again and again, it might seem like the citizenship of the Christians is in doubt. Paul's being a good citizen. The Christians are challenged to be good citizens. And by being a good citizen, there is a sense in which in all of our stories, the Christians aren't the one causing the riot. They're not the one creating the protest. They're the ones that are just trying to figure out why all this is going on, to remain well-behaved and nonviolent in the midst of it, to be peaceful but pious. And it's that piety, that devotion to the Lord Jesus Christ, which is often misunderstood as aggressive. Because Christianity, when it truly takes hold of our lives and our community's lives, it always undermines the status quo. It always does. It always pokes holes at the conventional ways, which can seem like we're being bad citizens or unpatriotic, when really we're the ones calling for greater health and wholeness and life and peace and joy and truth to pervade instead of the ways of Caesar, which are violence and aggression and hatred and mob rule and, you know, bureaucracy to some extent. But I think there has to be some bureaucracy somewhere. So that's my half point. My half point is there to say, be good citizens. Superman demands it. Be good citizens. But know that even in being good citizens, you might find that there is a certain misunderstanding because the way we want to be good just isn't necessarily always how the world defines good. Will you pray with me?